It is time for our featured speaker of the evening. Ladies and gentlemen in attendance and sober alcoholics around the world, it's sober time. Please show our Tulare County gratitude and welcome from Tahunga, California, with 12 years of continuous sobriety, Robert M.
We need more guys like you, for sure.
Hi, good evening. My name is Robert McElwain. I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to God and AA for my life today. Certainly didn't look like that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Julie, thank you so much for the honor and privilege to be able to speak here tonight on New Year's Eve, of all things. You know, guys like me should never wind up in places like this. And Amy, what a sweet gesture that is to give that your big book to Bill. I just, that touches my heart. You know, every time I give my guys my previous chips, you know, we just give this thing back, you know, and I can't give enough back to this program. And what a good heart that is in gesture. I also want to thank my two classmates over there from the class of 2005, Kyle and Rodney. We've been trudging this road together over there at Dunsmore, where we met over there, and Kyle is active in H&I. Rodney answers phones down at Central Office with my sponsor. And Julie, again, you know, thank you. I was telling her about my grand sponsor, Dave Mitchell. We in Los Angeles County, we had one central office. It was L.A. County Central Office. And Dave Mitchell lived in San Fernando Valley. And Dave went out there to L.A. County and said, look, San Fernando Valley's growing, and we need a central office out here. And they told Dave, they said, good, start one. And so my sponsor, Bob Fisher, he is actually manager today at San Fernando Valley Central Office. And I was listening to a recording from Sandy Beach. Many of you remember him. He's passed away. And he was talking about 1945, you know, people were staying sober back then, but they had one meeting. And I don't know about you folks, but could you imagine only having one meeting? And they would look forward to that one meeting, you know. They said the way they stay sober is he prayed like hell. Which, you know, this program is mostly about finding a power greater than ourselves. And so I think that's about it. Oh, and thank you so much for the warm welcome here in Alcoholics Anonymous and for the... And for the men and women before me that carry the message. And okay, so I'll just get started. I was born and raised in Los Angeles County and in a little place called Glendora. And my dad was an alcoholic, and he was very abusive to my mother. I found this out after I gotten sober, and I'll get into what happened there. But at 13 years old, my mom, while my dad was out on a bender in Tennessee, decided to contact her her brother-in-law, which was my dad's brother, and said, you know what, we got to move out of here before he gets home. And she moved us and my three sisters, my three perfect sisters, with no resentment in that voice, right? All of them A students, graduated high school. Anyway, they moved us all out there to Rosemead, and we settled down in this little house out there. And my first day in school, they threw all my stuff. Now, imagine this. My dad was very firm on butch haircuts, and That's just the kind of guy he was. He was from Tennessee, you know. If his neck wasn't red, he'd slap the back of it to make it redder. Anyway, he was just a hardcore guy, and sometimes he'd take the belt out and beat you a little bit too hard, you know, and be remorseful. He's one of those kind of drunks, but he loved his kids. And when my mom moved us away from that house, it broke my dad's heart, you know. I remember visiting him in Long Beach General when he was down there in a big book sitting next to him. And, you know, I loved my dad. And I was resentful at my mom for taking me away from my father. And in any event, once dad's gone, my mom said, well, you're going to be the man of the house, right? And so without any male direction or any other type of, not that I would have taken any anyways, but I get thrown into this different school district. Anyway, down there in Rosemead and San Gabriel, I'm the only white guy that shows up there in a crew cut. Now, this is middle of the year, and this is in, God, 1969. And I come into this place, and they had just had a talk in the auditorium that they were going to start having student police walk the campus. Guess who they thought was the cop? I was nicknamed in this place, you know, El Chota, you know, the cop, you know. And oh my God. And you either have to fit in or you find lower companions and you start hanging out with them. So I actually started doing that. And I hung out with this little crew of people that were doing home invasions way back before they were popular. And they'd break into medicine cabinets and in your homes and carry off TVs. And they weren't those little flat screen TVs. These were big ones. And they'd be robbing the medicine cabinets and taking everything in there and just seeing whatever color would work. And I remember my first drink was in 1969. I drank a Spinata. Anybody remember Spinata? Yeah, I know where they got the first name of that drink. It gave you the spins if you drank enough of it. And somebody told me, put your one foot on the floor. It doesn't work, you know, when you're laying down. Anyway, that was my first drink of alcohol. And we proceeded to drink Thunderbird and all this other kind of stuff. And back then, before they had cameras and liquor stores, we used to go into Circle K and we'd go in with our little gang of guys, man, and we'd just walk in and take cases and cases of stuff out of there and just walk out of the store, you know. And this is down there in San Gabriel, and we'd throw it over this brick wall and we'd go over there and get as drunk as we could. In any event, you know, my mom, she always wanted me to stay in school. And I wasn't going to school. You heard my story. I didn't fit in there. And so I got with this little gang of people that were doing a lot of stuff. Anyway, so I started ditching school a lot. My mom, you know, would try to get me to stay in school. The only thing she wanted me to do was be like my sisters, you know, and go to school and get an education. You know, God rest her soul, but she got to see me sober. I'll get to that point. In any event, she worked two jobs. She was on welfare. We used to get these toys delivered at Christmas, and it'd always be missing the main component, you know, from like the fire department and the, you know, those kind of people that would come. But we were, you know, she was doing the best she could. And then eventually she did get remarried to this guy. But before I get to that, I was ditching school a lot, and I took, and since no parental, you know, nobody was there, my mom was working two jobs, and I was ditching school, I started a little place in the back in the garage, and remember black lights and fluorescent paint? I used to paint all those little pillars in there, and we went and stole the roll of carpet, you know, the carpets that used to stand outside there. We'd throw it in the 60 Pontiac and carpet the floor because we need someplace good to pass out, and all the parents used to call and say, "Is my kid there?" And she'd yell out the back door, "Is little Susie there or little Joe there or whatever?" And of course, they'd be back there, and I'd hooked up a little amplifier back there. And anyway, it was just a grand time. And then, of course, you know, guys like me at 15, 16 years old, you know, you start playing around with the girls, and the next thing you know, I got somebody pregnant. She was 15, and I was 16 years old. And I remember when our parents approached us both and sat us down, they said, what are you guys going to do about this? And I puffed up my little 16-year-old chest and says, I'm going to take care of that kid. Well, you haven't even graduated high school. Well, I wasn't going to school anyway. So her father worked for the iron workers and says, well, no son-in-law of mine is going to be a bum. He put me to work as an iron worker for a little bit down in General Motors plant. And he says, I know you like to get loaded. And he says, but if I ever see you loaded or drunk on the job, he says, you're fired. And so I worked up there for maybe about 3 months. And then I thought I had everything handled and everything down pretty good. And so at lunchtime, I went up on the roof. And I smoked a little outside issue stuff, you know, a little pot back then. I was drinking low and brow. And I came back down, and instead of walking on the iron, I was scooting across the iron. And he spotted me, and he says, come on down. He says, you're fired. He says, but he goes, I still can't let you. He says, you still got to take care of my daughter. He said, so I'll put you to work at my bar. I said, hot dog, what a great place to work, you know. Anyway, so after a while, I got a good job, and I started driving for the Teamsters, and I was working in Santa Monica at this place. And my daughter had grown to be 3 years old at this time, and my little girl was waving goodbye to me when I was leaving. She was 3 years old, and the woman I should have married, but I never married her, was standing there at the top of the stairs, and she was holding her in her arms and say, bye, Daddy, I'll see you when you get home. Well, I didn't come home for 28 years. And I didn't know. Clancy one time spoke about there's things that we do that'll rip a hole in the fabric of your soul, that nothing, you know, can seem to heal, that type of thing. And I've got a few more of those instances, but I didn't see that at that time. Now, this little blonde down there in Santa Monica was making eyes at me, and so we moved in, set up house, and I actually married her. And then I abandoned the mother and that baby. Well, she never graduated high school either. I wouldn't let her work. She didn't have a job. I was the kind of guy that would come home and say and accuse her of things. You know, I was jealous guy, and I'd browbeat her when I came home. I'd say this house is filthy every time I come home, and I'd insult her. I mean, I was just I needed a drink. I needed a drink, and I needed to hang out with the guys. So I would do these things intentionally to push her away, you know, and that type of behavior. And I was young, and of course, I justified it every bit of the way that, you know, I deserve to go out and drink with my friends. I'm young. And so anyway, eventually I'm working down there in Santa Monica, and this little blonde picks up on me, and we go off and set up house. We're living down there in Palms in Mar Vista. Suddenly one night, I get a knock on the door, and there's Cheryl and the baby, and they're standing on my porch, and they're crying, and they're saying, Robert, how could you leave us like that? And I said, look, I don't even know if that kid's mine. And I said, I've moved on. I suggest you do the same thing. Boom. And I didn't even give it a second thought. I proceeded to get hooked up with a lot of other substances, and I started hanging around with different types of gangs. And you're looking at a guy that came out of prison. I'm a two-strike felon, and I didn't do a whole lot of prison time because I was able to fight a lot of cases. I made a lot of money selling drugs. And I gravitated to these outlaw bikers and these gangs, and I said, you know what, I like what they have, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. Bottom line. And so I learned how to be a distributor of sorts, and I was getting stuff out of Boca Raton and Florida, and then distributing down there on Adams and Crenshaw, 59th and Halldale, 109th and Main. I was that guy on that red and white Harley Davidson that just stood out I remember back in those days, a song came out by Peter Gabriel, and they called it Big Time. And they would, when they see me roll through, and I'd have my stereo blasting on that Harley Davidson, I'd play Big Time, so much larger than life. And you know, that's how I felt. You know, I had arrived. I made $3.5 million in seven years. I had the boat and the motorhome and the 59 Volvo and the 53 MG and all this kind of stuff. I had a beautiful house in Culver City. And we set up a house in there. And but I got, I should back up a little bit. I left that blonde for a woman that was a made woman in this motorcycle group. And she had a prior child with this individual, a very notorious violent biker group, and she was a maiden protected woman. And we set up this house down there in Culver City. Sorry, I got a little bit ahead of my story there. But we, that's where I gravitated to, lower and lower companions. And, you know, I had an ego so big it couldn't be smashed. As a matter of fact, Culver City had caught me dead bang many times. They made me drop the motorcycle in the middle of the street one time, and they caught me with over 5,000 pills on me. And they knew they had me. They had me dead to rights. And they brought me into court. And I had one of those really high-powered, from the motorcycle group, attorneys. And this attorney played golf with that individual that was prosecuting me. And when I walked into that courtroom, the attorney turned to me and he gave me a wink. And then the judge says, "Mr. McElwain, how does case dismissed sound to you?" And I said, "Wonderful, Your Honor. Thank you." And those 11 cops that were lined up against there, the very ones that busted me, glared at me as I walked out that room, and I thought, I'm even above the law. You know, they talk about our egos have to be smashed. An ego like that that thinks they can buy off anything or anybody, it's just really difficult to smash an ego like that, you know. And that's how I lived my life. You know, they said in this book, man, you know, the alcoholic life is the only one I knew. It's the only life that I knew. You know, so I ran with these people, and I did these horrible things out there, and for a long period of time, and in 1980, a lot of the cocaine and other substances started hitting the streets, and got displaced, and a lot of stuff that I was doing got displaced, and the next thing you know, I got addicted to a few of these substances myself, and I should mention that, you know, Bill Wilson mentions high-powered sedatives at page 7, so I'm mentioning them now, you know. But, you know, alcohol, I was always a sloppy, mean drunk. And, you know, when I did other substances, I could control it somewhat. But I came in here on a court card. I'm jumping ahead of myself again. In any event, so we were losing everything. I was starting to sell off, you know, the antique cars, my 56, my 57, the flat bottom boat, all this other stuff, and that we had, and we were living from hand to mouth at that particular time. It was about 1998, and we were just getting to the bottom of it. And Denise is the one that I was talking about, that we were together for 19 years at this point in time. We'd been through a whole lot of stuff, but we still had each other, right? And we had this beautiful little strawberry blonde child, you know, with us, and she was no longer a child. Now she's grown up. Anyway, we were the cool parents on the block, and if you were going to get loaded or high, we wanted you to, you know, we gave her permission to do that. And when Phyllis started drinking Cisco very heavily, and she, her organs, her liver was shutting down. All of her other organs were shutting down. She wound up down there in Long Beach Hospital. And I never want to forget that I came into that room and she was crying. She says, Bob, she says, I know if there was anybody that was going to show up, it would be you. And she says, tell me about God. And, you know, I was raised in a church. As a matter of fact, I was awarded a Bible when I was 7 years old, and I knew the Ten Commandments by heart. But I'd broken every one of those commandments by this time. And she's asking me to talk to her about God. And I've got this dirty, filthy leather jacket on, this cut and everything else, and I'm walking into that hospital. And her eyes are yellow. And I pull out of my pocket two syringes filled with heroin, and I says, here, honey. And she walked into that bathroom, and she did that stuff. And I watched her relax, and then the following day, I went home. And then the following day, we got the phone call that she passed away. And every day I had to watch Denise, you know, her mother, she would stare out the window and just be crying. You know, whenever I saw a tear floating down her eye, she'd lost her best friend. And but we still had each other, you know, at this time. And so I was making a little bit of money doing little deals here and there, you know. And so we were up one day on Pico and Sepulveda. And we were coming out of this little clinic up there, and I had a little bit of money. I had $20 in my pocket. Now, by this time, I had no real employment for no legitimate job for 14 years. My license had been taken away. It had been revoked. As a matter of fact, I had two $75,000 bonds against me ever being able to drive with a valid license again. And we're taking the bus at this point. So rising all the way from the top, here we are, but we have each other. So one more time, it's almost 9:30 in the morning, and I got to have something. But I knew that if she saw that $20, she was going to get some of it. So I got in an argument with her on the corner of Pico and Sepulveda. You know, one of those kind when you want to get away from somebody. And I said, look, just go over here and wait at this bus stop. I'll be right there. I'm going to go across the street and get a cup of coffee. And so I cross the street, and I'm standing there in this donut shop, and I'm getting this cup of coffee, and this little kid comes running in and says, Mr., Mr., and he's pointing down in the middle of the street, and I look down at the end of his finger, and there's Denise laying about three-quarters of the block in the middle of the street. Conrock Cement Company, a cement truck had hit her, and it's pulled over on the right side of the road. And I'm watching everything just go by in slow motion. And so the ambulance comes, UCLA, we take her up to UCLA Medical Center, and they get her totally out of the woods. They remove her spleen, she's got a broken hip, and she's got a tube in one side of her lung on this side. So they wheel her into the recovery room, you know, like they do with most people that are out of the woods, okay? And they said, you can see her for a moment. And so I walked in there, and I saw her, and the first thing she said to me over a trach tube, she says, I love you. I proceeded to feel that she was okay, and so I was going to go home and use that $20 that I was talking about, right? So later on that evening, the following morning, they were bringing a specialist in to put a pin in the hip, in her hip. Well, while she was under the anesthesia, the anesthesiologist had put the oxygen tube down into her esophagus instead of her lungs. And they lost her for a period of over 7 minutes. But they brought her back to life. And after a few bump starts, and she was in a coma. So every day, I'm going to her bedside, and I'm holding that beautiful hand, and I'm looking at her eyes rolled up in her head, and they'd come in and they'd prick her toe to see if she still had function to pain, and I'd say, she's going to come out of it. And they kept saying to me, no, she's not. And every day I could no longer be sober to go in there and see that. And no more that could I be drunk. I mean, I just couldn't. I was drinking a whole half gallon of vodka before I'd go in there and see her. And she, and every day I've got that voice in the back of my head, you know, looking at myself saying, over $20. You might as well just pushed her into that street. In a blind rage of anger that I put her in, she crossed that street in that crosswalk. That same crosswalk we crossed together for 7 years. And I was wanting to bring back the past. Now, I can't stay drunk and I can't stay sober. And at this point, I mean, I don't think any of you could either. And then the last words that you hear echoing in your just is that I love you. And I'm knowing I'm a piece of crap at this time. And so I am. And I'm thinking about Phyllis when she was asking about God. And I'm looking at her in this coma and watching her feet turn inward and all this other kind of stuff that happens from people staying in a coma. And for a year and a half, you know what? People are saying to me, Robert, you got to move on. And I just keep going and going to the bitter end. I'd turn to just walking the streets down there in Venice, Culver City. And I would try to panhandle for a little bit of money at this point. And I mean, I had nothing. I'd stand out there. I remember October, it was raining, and I was crying. And I didn't know what to do. And usually I'd just go up to people and just panhandle, but the money wasn't coming fast enough. And one day I really needed it. I needed it so bad. So these two ladies got off the bus, and I said, give me your money or else. Now, I didn't have that weapon on me, but now I'm down to 136 pounds, and I'm wishing I could die, you know, at this point. As a matter of fact, I tried a few attempted suicides, and they kept bringing me back. I'd go into these comas for a few days, and they'd say, welcome back, honey. You had a rough night. And I'd look at my arms and say, I'm not under arrest, and I'd leave. The one time I went into a center divider going down La Cienega, I was so loaded. It was broad daylight. And I passed out at the wheel, and I woke up 3 days later. And I used to have fence posts for teeth back then. And I went, and they weren't there. And they said, well, you left them in the center divider down there. And if you're new, don't worry about it. They grow back. So, one more time, you know, I do this little trick down there on Venice Boulevard, and I don't bother running away. I just go back to where I crawled from. And I these ladies that got off the bus, one went running away screaming. The other one stood there trembling, and she handed me her wallet. And she, I took $10 out of there, because vodka back then was $10.80. And I said, that's all I need. And so they take me to court. And first of all, the one lady that ran away got her husband, and they followed me back to this little place that I was at, okay? And the cops came, and they pulled me outside, and of course they identified me. And I remember back then they got me up to the judges in Santa Monica Superior, and they started to read this whole transcript, you know, back to back 211s, both the witnesses are here, so on and so on. Now I don't have attorneys to fight my case anymore. I've got a public defender, and so the public defender stands up and says, it constitutes 6 years and 6 years, Your Honor. And he says that's a total of 12 years that this man should be getting. And the judge looked over his podium, and he says, are you trying to tell me how to do my job, Mr. District Attorney? And apparently this judge read the transcripts, prior to. He says, I see something else going on here that you don't see. He says, I'm not giving this man 12 years. I'm going to give him 2 years in state prison. And mandated afterwards to go into a sober living program. So I go up and do a little reception up here in Delano, and they ship me up to Salinas Valley State Prison. I didn't do a whole lot of prison time and jail time. I was always able to fight off these cases and do all these things. When they read in the transcripts, that it was a strong-arm robbery, I thought to myself, well, it sounds more like aggressive panhandling to me. I didn't have a weapon. I wasn't going to hurt anybody. I just needed the money. So at this time, Denise is still in that coma. So every night I'm sitting there sober in this jail cell. And every night I'm thinking, when you're sober, things just are magnified. I was going like, man, they should at least let you at least smoke or do this or do something in there when you're kicking all this stuff. And anyway, they parole me eventually, and I get out. And this time I tried to go into sober living, and I couldn't stay. I had to go out and see Denise. Now, mind you, she laid in that coma for a total of 5 years. She finally passed away from complications. So she never came out of that coma. And so now I'm just looking for a way to kill myself at this time. So one last time, get in this Corvette and I go almost 200 miles an hour down the 101 freeway. This is October 26, 2004. I just came from an AA meeting that somebody thought that maybe I might be an alcoholic, and I just threw that big book in the back seat of the car and I just booked down there. I'd gotten it with a hostage from a bar that I'd hooked up with, this little Italian girl that had the hottest little Corvette and a nice place to drink at her house. And we're going down the PCH highway, and the cop pulls me over and says, you're on parole. And I'll never forget the look. She says, he is, like that. Oh my God, what did I pick up? So one more time, that constitutes some time, by the way. If you're on parole and you're going over 100 miles an hour, you get another little stint in jail. So this time I'm sitting there on a violation that I do 7.5 months up there in Tehachapi. So I get out, first of all, my cellmate, this guy that irritated the hell out of me, his name was Vinny, he came in there. I had this cell all to myself. I'm in reception up there, and he comes skipping in, and I said, dude, you got anything to read? He says, as a matter of fact, I do. He goes, it's this big book. Now, any self-respecting criminal doesn't want to be seen with a self-help book, right? And I said, no, I'm talking about something to read, like a Western or something like that, something I can get lost in. And he says, oh, there's some great stories in the back. And I just went, save that crap. And so he went to sleep, and when he went to sleep, he said he had 3 years, and that he got drunk on a bicycle. And one more time, he's sitting there in jail. He goes, I had a great out there. And so when he wasn't looking and he was sleeping, I picked up that little big book and I started reading some of the stories in the back. Thank God for them stories. I identified with the loneliness in there. It says Bill Wilson wrote in there, we know loneliness like no other, don't we? And towards the end, nothing in our lives, nothing in this man's life. And I got no family that'll support me anymore. Everybody's turned their back on me. And so I started going to the front of the book and I started reading some of the chapter 5, how it works. And I copied a couple sentences down and I wrote to my cousin. He was a priest, And I was trying to find someplace because I knew I was going to have to go someplace when I paroled, right? So, I copied a couple sentences. I found Alcoholics Anonymous is just great, in here, this and this and that. And so, here I am conning somebody again just to find a place. And he goes, well, you can stay at my house for a few days. And then I arrive out of prison and I go straight to his house and I set my stuff down. And he says, come on, Bob. And I says, what? Where are we going? He says, there's a meeting right down the street. Now? And now, I got paroled. You're just supposed to get $200 gate money, right? So I had to spend $20 of it on a pair of gray sweats. Now, I'm still in these gray sweats, and I'm setting my crap down on the floor, and he's telling me he wants to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me serious. So I go along, I'm going to just play his game, right? And so, you know, he takes me down to Dunsmore where I met these guys over here. And I never forget, Vinny says, just tell him, stand up and tell him you're new. Well, everybody knew I was new. You know, I had this long hair down to here, and I'll never forget that, you know, this one guy's, you know, he took, I kept going to meetings, and they put me on a court card. In the meantime, they put me on a court card, and I'm a two-strike felon. I'm going like, look, I'm state property. I served my time. And they said, you're right. You never have to drive with a valid license again. And I said, that's all right. I haven't had a license in 14 years. And he says, driving is a privilege, and I got $275,000 bonds against me ever driving a vehicle again. All my teeth are broken off at the gum line. And this guy, Tom, says, why don't you be a greeter? And I says, with what? I don't have any teeth. And it was embarrassing. Oh, my God. I never want to forget how bad it was when I was new. And I'm in these gray sweats. And then I find out I'm on this court card for six signatures. And I'm fighting with my parole officer. He says, no, you don't have to do AA, but you never have to drive with a valid license again. And I said, look, you can take away my license, but you'll never take away my ability to drive. You know, I'm still cocky and arrogant and just fighting everything. I don't know how to live, man. This is the kind of life I lived for a long time. And I'm an outlaw, you know, and I don't live by the rules. I've never had a bank account. I always kept money, you know, the way it was. It's just how it was for 48 years. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at 48 years old. My life's over. It's done. I can't even see that. I still want to have a plan somewhere. You know, maybe go back with the guys. And they're not even having me at this time. I mean, I'm pathetic. So I stayed despite myself. I heard a guy, Johnny H., back in those days. Many of you know him, and Clancy, and Frank Jones, God rest his soul, and Clint Hodges, and all these great, great guys. I go to this little meeting over there on the west side. You probably know about it, but there's about 1,200 people in attendance at that one, and just a small meeting. Anyway, I'm coming in, and I'm cocky, and I'm arrogant. I still like to wear my T-shirts long, and I got this facial hair, and I got hair down to here. You guys remember seeing me for 5 years like that. Kyle came in on a Prop 36. We both showed up at the same sober living, and we slept in the same room, but not with each other. But his wife and children used to come by and visit him, you know, in sober living, and I watched him slowly become a contractor, an electrical contractor, get all these certifications and put braces on his kids. I mean, he's just such a sweet man. And Rodney over there, he gives of his time at Autry and the Gene Autry place. And he's retired now. But anyway, so was my beginning of the journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I stayed beyond those six meetings, and I went to one point in time, I said, you know, I might want to actually drive with a valid license, you know, hanging around with you guys. I thought maybe it'd be a good idea. And so I went down to Superior Court, and I said, hey, listen, I'd like to get my license back. I know I owe $275,000 bonds. Can I make payment arrangements? And here's another judge. He says, he looks over there, he goes, I'm going to take a chance on you. And he says, I'm going to waive those $275,000 bonds. And by this time, I had tons of signatures from you guys. And he says, the court's satisfied with you. He says, now you'll have to go plead your case with the state of California to see if they'll give you your driving privilege back. So I had to take some steps in that direction. In the meantime, they said, Robert, you should probably get a job. And I said, no one's going to hire me. I'm a two three-strike felon. I said, who's going to hire me? And he said, well, what's your work history? And I said, well, I sold drugs. And he says, great, you're a salesman. And he said, go apply. And I'm going like, no one's going to hire me. Have you tried? And I said, no. And, well, go try. And the next thing you know, I get hired onto this little job, you know. God, I've been in sales now for a long darn time. The ironic thing is I'm a federal sales specialist through the GSA department now. And I sell to the Bureau of Prisons, of all things. And I handle all this sensitive information. And I work, you know, do a lot of computer imaging and hardware and stuff. You guys said if I put half the work into this stuff that, you know, I can have this great life. And so little by little, I got a medical insurance. And when I went to get all my teeth work figured out, they said it was going to be $60,000. Yeah, I said, that's not happening. But I enrolled anyway. And they said, look, your portion's only $5,000. They said, you can have it. And so this lady painstakingly put my whole face back together and all these implants and all this kind of stuff. It took about 3 years. And, of course, I was being honest with my doctors, telling them I can't take anything. I said, nothing from the neck up. I'm allergic to everything, you know. And I was taking Motrin back then, you know. And she says, you poor baby. She'd always hold my hand like this. And she said, do you have any pictures with your original smile and all this? And so anyway, eventually all that stuff got, you know, restored. And then 7 years into it, you know, I realized I had a 401k that I was contributing into. And it took every bit of 6 years to even for any credit agency to... It's one thing if you have bad credit, but if you've never had credit, and I had a bank account, a cell phone, and all this other kind of stuff, I was working, and I was trying to get credit, and nobody would give me credit because they had nothing. And so this guy, Garrett, man, helped me get a prepaid card at one time. And so I got that done. And then he said, he showed me how to actually start banking and building my credit. And at 7 years, you know, I got pre-qualified to buy a $500,000 home over there in Reseda. And I was going like, me? Guys like me? Are you kidding me? And I'm doing it all the honest way. In the meantime, you know, I'm having problems with people you know, I'm still, you know, don't like when things don't go my way, gosh darn it, you know. And one time this little girl came into my sales group, you know, and she was doing better than me. She was a young upstart, you know, and she'd say good morning to me every day, and I couldn't say good morning to her. And she, you know, one of those people that are nice to you. And you hi, Robert, how was your weekend? You know, it's like, oh, Jesus Christ. I said, yeah. She's making like four times the money. It's because you're a woman, you know. And so I'm not too happy about all this kind of stuff, and I'm starting to grow a little more spiritually with y'all. And so I go to my sponsor over there. I said, Bob, I said, man, I can't stand this girl. And, well, what's she doing? She's making more money than me, Bob, and I don't like her. And she says good morning to me. And he says, Robert, he says, I can help you with that. And I says, oh, good. I'm tired of hating her. And he says, a long time ago, Cecil gave him Cecil's grandmother's prayer. He says, tonight, when you go home, he says, I want you to say this prayer. I say, oh, okay, anything, Bob, I'll pray. You know, I'll pray. What do I pray for? You know. And he says, it goes like this. And you have to say it before you get under the covers tonight in bed. And he says, and it goes like this. Dear God, may I be treated tomorrow exactly the way I've been treating Jennifer today. And I said, Bob, I'm not saying that prayer. My very thoughts alone are bad. No. He says, well, then don't say the prayer. But like most of the things, the contrary actions that you guys have me do, you know, I went home and I said that prayer anyway. And the next day, you know, I wanted to react in a certain situation, and I said, oh, geez, you're going to be treated the same way, you know, if you do that. And so, you know what? Nothing changed, but guess who changed? Me. She didn't change. I changed. I changed. And so I use it almost like a seven-step prayer. God, let me be treated tomorrow exactly the way I've been treating everybody today. And Bob had taught me that one. And you know what? I got in this relationship, and we got this house, and Monique and I were together for 6 years, and I started to address some other medical issues. I had hepatitis C, and I've been fighting that for the last 3 years, you know, on different treatments, and right now I'm cleared of it, but 2 years ago, I was on that treatment, and ribavirin was driving me crazy, and this other stuff that I was taking, Sovaldi, ribavirin, Declenza, and I was fighting that stuff, but that stuff makes you a little bit on edge, and so I was sleeping in the living room, and things were going on. I was trying to hold my composure. You know, she gave me a beautiful 10-year party in my backyard, and is it time, Kyle? Yeah, it might be. But you know, eventually I was cocky and arrogant at that house too. You know, I was bringing in guys and sponsoring them and taking them through the book, and she started this big job, and she got the six-figure job down on the west side, and she's making a ton of money, but she's working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and 6-7 days a week, and she's telling me I'm never home. Well, I get home at 2:30. I said, what are you talking about? I'm always home. And then when she'd get home, I'd be sponsoring guys. And she said, what is everybody doing here? Now, she was going to meetings at one time, too. But those last couple of years, she was making money. And December 26, 2 years ago, I went to bed just not to fight with her. And she came alongside the bed, and she says, get the hell out of this bed. She says, get out of this house. And I says, I don't have to leave this house. I said, it's our house, you know, and I'm trying to have her go to counseling, and I'm not going to tell her how to do her program or to call a sponsor or anything else. And so she left out of the bedroom, and she came back into the bedroom, but this time she had a butcher knife this long in her hand. And, you know, in a moment of clarity and compassion for that, too, I said, you know, but by the grace of God, I'd go, too. If I wasn't going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsoring people, she was very active for a long time. So at 10 years sober, you know, I quick deeded the house over into her name, little dog that we had. And so I had to begin my life over again. And I said, you know what, if I need to have back all the way to the deed office, I was just saying, let go, let God, you know. She wanted to buy the house out, and so she had bought the house out. And I remember one of our traditions, it states that money, property, and prestige should never divert us from our primary purpose. My primary purpose was to be and stay in that relationship. And so I stayed active here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I built my life from there. And recently, like I said, it'd been 3 years on that treatment, and I got cleared from hepatitis C, and I've been, all my blood levels are amazing. You know, they put me on a cardio machine. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I should be dead. I remember walking into jail at times, and they kept playing this video when you were in reception. You know, it's up there on the top of it, and it says, and it was, oh, God, it's that one with Bill Murray. It's Groundhog Day. I remember every time I walked in, it was just like Groundhog Day. Every time I'd be going in and out and in and out. You know, and I had the great honor to be one of the 10-minute sharers at that big meeting, and Frank Jones talked. And at the end of his talk, he would always say, rarely have we seen a person fail. It was thoroughly follow our path. You know, to those that are new, that's an absolute true statement. You know, I just need to follow what you guys do. I love our our traditions so much, especially our 12th one, this is the end, our great gifts will never spoil us, that we live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. You know, to practice a genuine humility, does that mean sometimes I do things that I don't want to do? Here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll go to any length to stay sober. I have a primary purpose here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know I do today. I was saved by a loving God that I would think that thought that would never forgive me. And I guess it's time for me to stop. But thank you so much for allowing me to come up tonight and share with you.
Thank you, Ronald.